Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We will hear now our first case for this morning, S.C. Johnson against Transport Corporation, 113577. Mr. Clement.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. This appeal presents a single dispositive question of law, whether the F Quad A preempts claims based on bribery, kickbacks, and racketeering in the transportation industry. The answer is no. These general criminal prohibitions simply do not relate to prices, routes, or services in a manner forbidden by the F Quad A.
But you do agree that they relate directly to price in your case, in that your claim seems to be that the existence of these schemes caused your client to enter into contracts at a higher price for transportation services than it otherwise would have had.
Well, Judge Wood, I think that these claims do relate to price in the way that any general common law claim is going to relate to price if it's applied to this industry. But I don't think that can be the test. And I think if you look at this Court's cases have asked whether the law, which is the focus of this preemption provision, the preemption provision in the Federal Code focuses on the law, and asks whether it relates to prices, routes, or services. And this
So where do you get the idea, though, that when it says that, it means, in a sense, a regulatory law, a law that addresses price levels, for example?
Well, I mean, one could certainly get that notion if one looked at the legislative history, for example. But I don't think that our position in this case turns on you accepting the proposition that the only way to interpret that statute is to say that it relates to rates, prices, and services in a regulatory sense. Because we think that ultimately the test that you derive from the Supreme Court cases is whether the connection between the state law and the prices, routes, and services is too tenuous, remote, or peripheral to count. And I think, you know, as I look at the Supreme Court cases, they've really rejected two kind of polar opposite positions. One would be the position that a law of general applicability, by definition, doesn't relate to prices, routes, and services. That Justice Stevens found that.
So tort, for example, or even consumer fraud.
Exactly. So Justice Stevens found that view attractive, but the rest of the Court didn't. Another view would be to say that any time you take a law of general applicability and apply it to the transportation industry, that that's enough to make it relate to prices, routes, and services. Now, I read the Supreme Court as basically rejecting those two alternatives, which puts us in the middle, which puts us in the relatively difficult task of figuring out what kind of connection is too tenuous, remote, or peripheral to count. Now, I think if you look at the Supreme Court's cases, they do provide you, admittedly in dictum, some help. And, you know, if you look at Morales, which started the trend of saying too tenuous, remote, and peripheral, one of the things that it points out is that it's one thing if the state regulates the price aspects of advertising, quite different if all they say is that you cannot have obscene depictions in advertising. And I think that's really instructive, because why wouldn't that relate to prices, rates, and services in a way that counts? Because you can charge any price you want. You can offer any service you want. You can advertise any price. You can advertise any service. It doesn't matter. All you have to do is refrain from obscene depictions. In the same way,
that's quite different from your claim, which is the claim that this dishonest employee was taking these payments or benefits, let's just say broadly, and the price of the contracts is different. I mean, it seems to me you're focusing on this at 3,000 feet up or 30,000 feet up, and your case is a case that fundamentally complains about price.
Well, with respect, it doesn't, Your Honor. We don't really care about price so much as the fact that we care about there not being bribes and kickbacks that distort the price.
The state case in which your client got that big judgment, wasn't that the damage on that measured by the overpayment on shipments? Isn't that how you got to $200 million?
I think that was a component of it, Your Honor. I don't think – two things, though. One is, I don't think there's any law that says that you can't – that it's preempted if you make reference to price in calculating your damages. Of course, that couldn't be the rule, because oftentimes in contract actions, you're going to make a reference to the prices that were charged in assessing the damages in the contract action. The second thing is, I mean, if that's the rule, which I don't think it is, but if that were the rule, it wouldn't be a basis for throwing out the complaint in toto. Because the complaint certainly does complain that we were charged too much. It complains that we had things that really weren't so much an overcharge in the sense that we got exactly what, you know, we just should have got a little less. For just as a for instance, we have complaints that we were charged for refrigerated service when we didn't need it, and that was all as a result of the bribes. But we also allege in you know, just to be specific, and I think it's paragraph 71 of the complaint, we allege that SC Johnson was injured in terms of its market position. You know, ultimately, I suppose, because it got inefficient service, ultimately, in part, because it paid too much for the service. But we don't think those are the kind of things that are beyond the realm of what a jury can consider or what would cause preemption. And I think, Judge Wood, what's critical is if you think about the bribery laws and the kickback laws, even in our case, even as applied to this industry, they don't care what price you charge. They're totally indifferent to what price you charge. Charge any price you want. Offer any service you want. Simply refrain from bribing people to accept the price.
Well, and that's precisely what the criminal laws in this area focus on, and there have been criminal prosecutions. But one thing that bothered me about the theory in your brief was the notion that just because criminal laws are out there, there must be some civil counterpart to enforce the same concepts. And you know that that's not what the Supreme Court has been saying of late, that there's a realm for public enforcement of various kinds, and there may or may not be a realm for private enforcement.
Oh, but with respect, Judge Wood, I don't think they would say this about this statute, because this statute is specifically directed at the state. And if you look at this statute, the question isn't why would this statute apply to a state criminal prosecution. The question you would have if you just read the statute is why would this apply to a state tort action at all? Because the focus of the text of the statute is a state law or a state enforcement action. Now, of course, the court has said, well, you know, a state court enforcing a tort action is a species of an enforcement action. But that's just why, in the context of this particular statute, I think there clearly would be parallelism between a state criminal prosecution and a state tort prosecution that simply tries to get damages for essentially the violation of the state criminal prohibition on bribery and kickbacks. So I do think the logic of accepting Apelli's position here is that a state criminal prohibition on bribery, state criminal prosecution, would also be barred in this industry by the F-Quad-A.
But, you know, the state criminal prosecution wouldn't require anybody to worry about the amount of the overcharge that you paid, for example.
And nor would the state tort action inherently, Judge Wood, which I think is the question you would ask at this stage of the case. To be sure, SC Johnson has to show that there was some harm, so it gets into court in a tort action. But the way that you could prove harm here is if you needed to. I don't think you do. But if you needed to, you could surely prove harm by without reference to the specific rates charged. I mean, you could prove harm by the amount of the bribes, for example. I think that shows that we were harmed. You could show...
Yeah, you've alluded to that very glancingly, I think, in a footnote in your opening brief and then maybe a little bit more in the reply brief. But I didn't see that theory developed much, that you were just going to look at the amount of the bribes that were actually received by the dishonest employee, Mr. Morris, I think, and maybe one of his cohorts. But why is that a measure of anything?
I think it's a measure of harm. I think it shows, I mean, you know, and I think you can assume that people are bribing relatively efficiently.
It's
and
not
so,
a measure of fraud damages under Wisconsin law.
No, but I think it's one way of trying to prove up. Again, I think you have to separate the questions of whether or not you have damages, which is something you ultimately prove up. But then the separate question of, to get in the door, the only difference between a state criminal prosecution for bribery and a tort prosecution is you have to show some measure of harm. And I think that would show some measure of harm. I think SC Johnson's competitive disadvantage from this scheme is enough to show harm. So I just don't think this is a situation where you have to prove up any particular relationship to rates.
Is there some reason a rescission equitable contract claim wasn't pleaded in this case? Was there a time bar? Was it just overlooked? I mean, that would clearly get you into the contract exception.
Well, I think, Judge Sykes, that, you know, I don't know exactly why that wasn't the theory that was offered in this complaint. I think there may, with at least respect to some claims, like a federal RICO claim, for example, I think there would have been some statute of limitations issues. Now, there might have been a basis for tolling and that sort of thing. But I think in framing the complaint, SC Johnson said, let's focus on these state claims. These state claims are clearly, at least the four that we're principally talking about here, are not time barred. And the only possible objection would be this preemption analysis. And I think SC Johnson took the position quite correctly that as to these claims, based on a scheme of bribery and kickbacks, that based on that scheme, there should not be preemption. And I certainly think, you know, appellees want to present this world where the only law that you're allowed, the only state law you're allowed to use against carriers is contract law. And with all due respect, I mean, that's not consistent with the text of the FQAA, and it's not consistent with the Supreme Court precedent. I mean, every time the Supreme Court has confronted this provision, it's always essentially avoided the reductio ad absurdum that it's contract law or nothing. They've always been willing to reserve, whether it's a prohibition on gambling, a prohibition on prostitution, obscene depictions, or whether it's providing contraband to minors. I think in all of those situations, the court has said, look, that, you know, certainly suggested in dictum, that that would not be preempted.
So how do you draw conceptually the line between those sets of generally applicable laws that don't create problems here and the laws that are going to be preempted? So you've just rolled through a few. And why isn't bribery and kickback something that's very economic, in a sense, very related to price, related to service?
Well, here's why I think bribery and kickbacks are the easy case, because bribery and kickbacks, like the ban on obscene depictions, but frankly, unlike prohibitions on gambling and prostitution, do not relate to prices, routes, or services in any way, because they're indifferent to the prices you charge, to the routes you offer, and to the services you offer. And that's, as I say, that's true of the obscene depiction ban. It's true of the ban on kickbacks and bribery. I mean, you know, you could have an airline, you know, Vegas Airlines, that, you know, presumably offered gambling as a service. And even that, the Supreme Court says, no, that's too tenuous and remote. That's, and clearly what they're talking about, ultimately, is it's too tenuous and remote to what Congress was on about in this provision. And, you know, I do think that, you know, I mean, the last word from the Supreme Court is the Roe case. The Roe case certainly did look at the legislative history. Indeed, Justice Scalia wrote separately to complain that Justice Breyer looked at the legislative history. Exactly. Well, but that just, and if you take even one peek at the legislative history, then it's clear that this is not something that Congress intended to preempt, which is the ultimate.
Is I can imagine a rational world in which one said laws of general applicability are not what Congress was worried about. They just didn't want their deregulatory efforts to be undermined by state laws coming in and essentially re-regulating industries. But by the time you have Morales and this whole line of cases, I don't think we're in that clean world. I think we're in a world where, when perhaps even at an as applied level, when the particular complaint deals with prices and services, then you've got to give way and just let the criminal law do its work if it needs to.
With respect, Judge Wood, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's the test that either emerges from the Supreme Court cases, which clearly say that some criminal laws are too tenuous in their relationship to prices, routes, and services, and we think this is squarely within that. It's also not
But bribes and kickbacks determine which company gets the business, doesn't it? And it builds into the price. If you pay a bribe, you're going to have to get that back somewhere, won't you?
I suppose that's right, but I suppose that's one more reason why this couldn't possibly come within the intent of Congress. Because Congress is attempting to deregulate here. It's attempting to basically let market forces dictate who gets what contract. To the extent that bribes and kickback interfere with market forces and have a contract go to somebody who shouldn't get it based on their competitive advantage. I mean, you got here a company in Texas that's getting the Canadian routes. That's not the product of market forces. That's the product of market distortions.
It's Mr. Clement. You can't possibly be insulting the state of Texas.
I'm only insulting it as a logical base of operations for serving Canada. That's the only way in which I try to get any offense.
Country.
And the last thing I want to say about this is, again, if you look at the congressional intent at all, you know, obviously the arc of this statute is pretty easy to understand. They deregulated the federal level. Now, it's worth noting that when they deregulate at the federal level, they don't say, well, in order to deregulate, we need to create an exception for this industry from the federal bribery laws, the federal RICO laws. That's not in their conception of what deregulating means. They then realize that they have a problem. Some states are re-regulating in a way that interferes with the federal scheme. Now, they identify 41 states that are re-regulating in a way that interferes with the federal regime. Interestingly, one of the nine that doesn't interfere is Wisconsin. And now, that's not because Wisconsin didn't enforce its bribery laws. It's not because it didn't have laws like this on the books. Nobody would have thought of a basic, generally applicable prohibition on kickbacks and bribery as being a state re-regulatory effort that this provision wanted to try to reach. And so if you take a step back and think that ultimately the question in any preemption case has got to be what would Congress have intended, it seems to me beyond the pale to say that Congress would have wanted to and say that essentially in this industry, bribery and kickbacks are beyond the reach of the civil law to reach.
I'm curious that you don't run with this federal RICO concept a little bit, because if a federal civil RICO would not interfere with this deregulation, doesn't that help your...
I think it very much does help us. I think it shows, it helps us in a number of respects. It shows that the fact that federal RICO has coexisted with the deregulation at the federal level shows you that a RICO action is not the kind of thing that interferes with what Congress is trying to address, either in the original deregulation or in the F-Quad A preemption provision when they try to displace the states.
Okay, and so before you sit down, if you want to save rebuttal time, I want to know whether your idea of preserving the proper operation of markets means that you're asking us to disagree with the Ninth Circuit's In Re Korean Airlines decision in which they found that the application of the state's unfair competition law was preempted.
No, we're not asking you to disagree with that, Your Honor, because we do think that's distinguishable. We do think things like unfair competition laws get much closer to, you know, what Congress was concerned about.
But
you know,
price fixing distorts markets terribly.
It does. But again, I just don't think this is in an area where, in light of what the deck that the Supreme Court has dealt with, you can just take one principle and say, we're just going to run with it to the finish line. I think if you know, I'd be happy with the Ninth Circuit law, frankly, because the Ninth Circuit law generally does recognize that you're generally worried about economic regulation. So the Ninth Circuit has held in cases, for example, that a minimum wage law is perfectly consistent with the F-Quad A as applied to this industry, even though, frankly, I think it has more of an effect on prices than this law does, because this law, unlike a minimum wage law, says charge any price you want. Just refrain from bribery and kickbacks, if I could reserve.
Yes, you are welcome to reserve. And we will hear from Mr. Reedy.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Your Honor, this case starts, as some of the questioning reveals, from the premise that if you look at the complaint in this case below, it's very, very clear that the thrust of the tort actions below are not at all tenuously related to what is preempted.
But yet I will say, when Wisconsin passed its law prohibiting bribery and kickbacks and the like, the regulation of the airline industry has to have been the furthest from their mind. These are general laws that are prohibiting criminal behavior and that may be enforceable in other ways. And so I don't see, from the point of view, it depends which end of the telescope you're looking through, but from the point of view of why do these laws exist, it looks to me like you are dealing with very broad laws indeed.
I don't think there's any question that it is not an analysis of do these laws exist to regulate rate price. I think Morales and the other cases set forth that they can be laws of general applicability like torts.
Well,
so long
Morales,
as they impact.
Though, I mean, dealing with an airline's frequent flyer program, that's price if at least people who waste as much time on airlines as I do recognize that this is, in a sense, just an alternate way of paying for your tickets, very closely related to price.
I quite agree, as is complaining, as they do here, that they overpaid their price, that they paid for services they did not receive, and that routes were awarded, the very three things that are preempted in the preemption statute.
That's not the gravamen of any of these causes of action. That it may be the measure of damages appropriately under Wisconsin law, but the gravamen of the offense is criminal wrongdoing actionable in tort.
And I think that's worth focusing on. I actually think that the notion that the fact that the underlying crimes or the underlying activity is said to be potentially criminal, because no one was charged in the cases underlying the allegations here, but if that's said to be potentially criminal, that's an exception that would swallow the rule almost entirely. All that someone would have to plead in order then to be outside of the preemption statute would be to plead that what happened below, the tort, the underlying tort, fraudulent conveyance, fraudulent inducement, whatever it might be, is a tort that could have been charged criminally. And in this case, and what that would do is, among other things, in terms of swallowing the rules, it would just challenge people like me who have a prosecutorial background to simply say that fraudulent inducement is the same as a fraud, which it is. And if you look at the cases, each and every case, or not each and every case, but the vast majority of the cases could easily have been pled alleging that the underlying conduct was criminal.
But I thought you conceded that something like, you know, a battery on an airplane wasn't preempted, that somebody could still bring a lawsuit for all sorts of tortious activity.
That's quite correct, because the battery doesn't relate to prices, services, or rewards in the way this
services.
Well, I suppose one could conceive of a way in which it would relate to services. And again, as the Supreme Court teaches us and the Seventh Circuit teaches us, you have to look at each case as it comes up. So there may be a case in which it could relate to services. But generally speaking, I don't think it does. And what I would urge the Court to do is to look at Mesa, Wolins, Morales, Stratlin, Data Manufacturing, and, as the Court's already noted, In re Korean Airlines. Those Mesa is a case for fraudulent inducement. In order to plead fraudulent inducement as a crime, all you have to do is say, at the time the contract was entered into, they had no intention of performing. They were making misrepresentations in the contract. That's a fraud.
Well,
that could easily be read into the fraud statutes of every state in the land.
But Mesa also says a simple fraudulent inducement claim is different from a contention that one party knuckled under to a show of force by the other. Mesa wasn't attempting to write for all time. Surely bribes and kickbacks are something also outside the realm of regular fraudulent inducement.
No, I don't think that they necessarily are. What the Court says, and they make much of the dicta in both Morales and in Mesa that talk about other things, and the way the Court approaches it in Morales, where they talk about prostitution and gambling, is very interesting because they're basically knocking down the very same argument that's raised by plaintiffs here. In Morales, the Texas AG said, well, you can't allow this to be preempted, our statute to be preempted, because to do so would allow prostitution and gambling. You'd have to do the same thing there. And all the Supreme Court does in Morales is saying, we're not starting down the road of saying whether or not prostitution or gambling. I think by way of saying, that's not before us, and there may be crimes or activities that are not covered by this preemption statute.
But, you know, I want to get back in part to the point that Judge Sykes made a few minutes ago and in part to something we were discussing before. And that is, first of all, the fact that this complaint is about the bribes. It's not about overcharges or anything. There may be some later time where the measure of damages comes in, but that's not the same thing as bringing a lawsuit for, say, an overcharge. And secondly, it's the purpose of this deregulation statute. It's to make sure, this preemption clause is to make sure that the states don't re-regulate. The states have bribery laws of general applicability. They may happen to have some effect in the airline industry. They have an effect in every other industry in the state. And I don't see in any common sense way why this interferes with the preemption provisions.
I think it interferes with the preemption provision in a common sense way because you can't draw a distinction among the commonly or the generally applicable torts that makes sense, even if you start with what is commercial bribery. If you look at their complaint and you try and figure out what it is they're talking about, they have more than 20 paragraphs that refer to inflated rates, services that weren't necessary, awards of routes that weren't appropriate. The very three
show the impact of the bribery on them, right? Or they wouldn't really even have standing, perhaps. I mean, they can't just come in as a bystander and say, we think it's bad that somebody in a particular company was bribing. So that's the influence of the bribes. But there are some state laws of general applicability that do apply to the transportation industries. I shouldn't say just airlines. Obviously, we're doing trucking here. But why not this one?
Well, we're not saying that the law of bribery, in this case commercial bribery, doesn't apply. That may very well apply in the next case that's brought where there's a prosecution under commercial bribery.
Mr. Clement thinks that's impossible. If we rule in your favor, he says that law's out too.
And that's probably the biggest red herring in this case. There is no possible, and it's the same thing that was rejected in Morales and the same thing that was rejected in Mesa. In Morales, the court says, I'm not going down that road. You can't make your argument by taking me to the idea that we are going to be preempting criminal prosecutions if we preempt this.
But
that's what they say they won't do, and you shouldn't do it here either.
How does this state enforcement, I'm looking at the language from Roe, have a connection with or reference to carrier rates, routes, or services? I don't see either connection or reference. It's, you know, don't engage in this criminal conduct. What about extortion? Do you think that also is preempted on the civil side?
If it's on the civil side with respect to how, and the case is brought in damages, it's possible, by the way, and this is what Mesa talks about in dicta, is if you attacked the formation of the contract in a contract action, say a rescission, then you might have an action under contract that would not be preempted. What you have here instead is the 20 paragraphs that talk about what their actual measure of damages is and what they're obviously attacking here, which is the rates they paid, the services that were awarded.
Suppose the four-year statute of limitations for RICO had not, as it apparently seems to have done, barred a RICO action at this point, and a RICO action had been brought. Would you take the position that that was preempted?
I would not. It seems to me that it's quite clear that the preemption statute is meant to keep the states from re-regulating under state law. And it has nothing to do with whether or not there are laws under the federal statutes that could apply, which would be applied in federal court, and which has its own set of safety built into it as opposed to a state re-regulation attempt. So it's only about state laws that they're trying to preempt.
Well, obviously preemption doesn't apply to federal laws. There's a comparable notion that you've got to figure out how federal laws live with one another and whether they're reconcilable or not. But so you think a state RICO action is barred, even though a federal RICO action wouldn't be?
A state civil RICO action for damages of this nature, seeking rates, awards, services, yes, that would be, and the state and the federal action would not be.
So what if it was just, as Judge Sykes has been suggesting, what if it were just a rescission? We're trying to recoup the bribes that were paid.
I think that all the recouping the bribes that were paid, which is something I think that was invented with change of counsel in this case, but if that were the case as a hypothetical, that's actually still about rates. When you look at cases, and there's a case by Judge Posner and others in this circuit that talk about that, when you say bribes were paid and I wish to have the value of those bribes back, what you're actually saying is I paid X. I would have paid X minus the value of the bribes, which is a rate, which is a price.
But we don't want to go to an absurd level. I mean, there are some people, perhaps even some affiliated with this circuit, who think everything can be reduced to economic transactions. But in fact, these laws focus on different things. Some laws focus on price. Some laws focus on regulation of obscenity. Some laws focus on other kinds of activity. And Congress didn't give us an alternative regulatory structure in this statute to deal with bribes and kickbacks. You seem to want to just leave it completely in a free-for-all.
No, I don't think that's what the preemption ruling does here. And again, if you look at the other cases that have held preemption generally applicable, they're fraud cases. Wolins is a consumer fraud case. That could have been pled as a crime. So if the concept is, and this is where you really see them struggling, and actually what the court asked about earlier, is how do you define which of the generally applicable torts will be preempted and which ones will not be preempted? And they offer you a set of divisions that are not acceptable. They offer you non-garden variety, non-run-of-the-mill, and finally, in the reply brief, they talk to you about these crimes being malum in se, which is without citation and which would not survive a citation to Black's Law Dictionary as to what a malum in se crime is. Commercial bribery is not a malum in se crime.
So what's your line?
Our line is to focus on the claims, and if the claim seeks to impact or would impact rates, services, or awards, then it's preempted if it's a civil state claim.
Minimum wages. Surely the wages that a company pays its employees affect its pricing.
Well, I would say that there probably is a point at which the state intent and the state's abilities to regulate various actions and et cetera becomes tenuous, or so tenuous that it is not preempted, which is the holding with respect to the minimum wage. But that is not true of a complaint like this one. And we are forced to look at their claims. They only want to talk about what they say is the conduct here. They don't want to focus on their claims. Preemption is about claims. And their claims here clearly are directed at price. Rates, price in the form of rates, services, and awards. And so that's the rule, and that's the rule that we already have in the cases. This case actually is MESA. There's no way to substitute. You could have pled the MESA complaint to be a fraud or to be a crime under Illinois law. When you fraudulent inducement, which was the complaint in MESA, all you have to do is say that it was a misrepresentation in the contract at the beginning, and the only thing that keeps that from being a prosecutable offense is the discretion of a prosecutor. So the rule cannot be the one they offer this court. The rule has to be the rule that is set forth in the cases that already exist, which is that the torts of general applicability are preempted if they are interfering with the rates, awards, and services, or seeking to impact or impacting. And in this case,
that's
very clear.
That's a very interesting distinction you just made. Seeking to impact, this fails. Impacting, it may meet.
Which is why I corrected myself.
I noticed.
I said seeking impact. It is impact, and the case law is impact, and I need impact.
There were contract remedies that survived in MESA, and as I understand your argument, it is comprehensive here. There are no remedies that survive for plaintiffs injured by bribery and kickback schemes.
It would depend, again, on how the case was pled and what it was. If they sought to rewrite their rate contract and sought to, basically, as they do here, and say, I now want to bring it to a Wisconsin court or have Wisconsin law determine whether or not this should have been a fair market value rate, whatever that is, and should have been determined in that way, then I think that it's going to be preempted. But it's not, everything is not going to be preempted with respect to the underlying criminal activity, certainly. So if you want to charge the crime, you can charge the crime. But I think MESA does hold that, and preemption of necessity holds in certain circumstances, that if the remedy you seek, if the claim that you're making would impact the things that are preempted, rates, awards, services, then you are without a state court remedy. As this court has already pointed out, these guys forewent a possible remedy under the federal RICO action if they wanted to bring one. So it may or may not be that there isn't a remedy, but the nature of preemption is to leave people without remedy. That's what it is. When it's applied to the tort world, it left you without remedy in MESA, it left them without remedy in Morales.
Usually there's some federal regulatory apparatus that provides a lesser remedy, maybe not the full remedy that state law would provide, but some sort of a recourse for the injured party. And that just doesn't exist here.
Yeah,
or at least the type of regulation like in the FDA where tests are reported and there's an ongoing obligation so that the public is protected. There's no equivalent here.
Well, I think that, and we didn't necessarily, this wasn't addressed necessarily, but there are federal remedies that exist with respect to going to the transportation safety. We don't argue them, the transportation Surface Transportation Board, to complain about various things. You could go and complain if somebody was bribing everyone, and there might be a remedy therein. But I don't think that any preemption case has ever gone off on the concept of, if we rule that Congress intended to preempt a tort like this, and it leaves the plaintiff without a remedy in state court for this particular kind of tort, then preemption doesn't apply. That can't be the law of preemption. Preemption is about preempting state actions, and if it preempts a state action and no one can find a federal analogy to it, then you're preempted.
Right, that's true, but it affects the evaluation of congressional intent. So, you know, if this case were being argued on a first principles basis and we were looking at how the preemption clause should be interpreted with respect to its purpose and congressional intent, then it affects that calculus.
Well,
because that's an extremely broad sweep.
I think that's fair. But if you look at the other cases and what they have preempted, Korean Airlines preempted price fixing, straight up price fixing.
Well, it is a little bit hard to say price fixing doesn't relate to price. And so perhaps the Ninth Circuit was correct to say you know, the California Cartwright Act just can't apply here because it regulates the price mechanism, and that's one of the things Congress was talking about.
Data manufacturing is a fraudulent misrepresentation case. Mesa was fraudulent inducement. Those are cases where there is an alleged tort, where they don't have regulatory relationship on their face to what's going on here, but where the courts have repeatedly recognized, if they affect the rates and services, that they are preempted. And if that leaves somebody without a state remedy and they wish to forego their federal remedy by not bringing it or for some other reason, then that's where they are. And if there is no federal remedy, it's still preempted.
I need to clarify something you said earlier about available contract remedies. Fraud in the inducement is actionable in contract as well as in tort, and it gives rise to an action for rescission and restitutionary damages, which would be measured by reference to the difference in price. Not just the amount of the bribes, but the difference in price. That's the measure of damages for restitutionary awards for rescission when a party is trying to unwind a deal where the contract is vitiated because of fraud in the inducement.
And I think
what you said earlier is that contract remedy would also be preempted, which seems to run in the teeth of what the Supreme Court has said about contract remedies.
If I said that, I misspoke. Mesa makes it clear that if you were going to a rescissionary measure and you were that might still survive because it's an action in contract. And it's very clear that this preemption does not mean to take away an action in contract. So if their contract had said, here are the following regulations with respect to how expensive golf you can provide our purchasing agents or what other benefits you can provide our purchasing agents, and if as a result of a breach of that, the contract further provides that the remedy will be as follows, a determination of fair market value, that might be a remedy with respect to a contract, so too with rescission. Here they had the opportunity, if they wished to try and do it, to replead rescission or a contract action, and they forewent that opportunity to bring this issue here to this court. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Reedy. Anything further, Mr. Clement? I think you have about 4 minutes or so? Yeah, okay.
Your Honor, just a few points in rebuttal. First of all, the test in this circuit, as I understand it, is significant economic impact. And here, I think if you think about the bribery and kickback and state racketeering laws, they do not have a significant economic impact on price. Indeed, I think they have no economic impact on price because the laws are that you can charge any price you want as long as you refrain from bribery.
And people sometimes think of bribery as a tax, basically. I mean, think of all the societies that are plagued with bribery. Prices are too high, quality is too low, and the money is siphoning off. So bribery does have a significant economic impact on transactions.
With respect, I don't think it does, at least in the way that should matter for the statute, which is you ask yourself, I think the way to think about this is you conceptualize the tort claim as if it were going to result in injunctive relief. And you ask, would that injunctive relief have a significant impact on price? I think a rule that says charge any price you want, just refrain from briberies and kickbacks, does not have a significant economic impact on price. By contrast, you think about Morales. I mean, you know, the law there, they're trying specifically to prohibit you from price advertising. In Woolens, they're basically trying to prevent you from changing your frequent flyer program. In Roe, they're basically saying you have to offer a service that's not available in the market. This is very different, and for that reason, I don't think there's a significant economic impact, and I don't think there's preemption. If I could talk about the use that appellees try to make of Morales, I mean, the court in Morales wasn't saying this is a civil action for gambling and prostitution, and we don't have to decide whether the criminal laws would be prohibited. They're saying this is something directly in the teeth, a state re-regulation effort that deals directly with price advertising. We're not going to definitively resolve here today about gambling and prostitution, but we're going to strongly hint that those are not covered. As the court reiterates that in Woolens and Roe, they basically reiterate it as if they've held that things that are too remote, tenuous, and peripheral are not preempted, and we think this is a classic case of that. We certainly don't think there is a way to really distinguish between a state prosecution for bribery and a tort action that uses bribery essentially as the standard of care, which these counts do. And again, if you go back to the text of the statute, I think you'll see why. The text of the statute is specifically directed at a state enactment or state enforcement of a law. So if there's a problem with bribery because it gets to price, that clearly would also equally apply to a state prosecution.
What about this argument that any garden variety civil fraud can be reconceptualized as a crime?
Well, I think that's – I mean, I don't totally disagree with that, which is – that's why I think at least in the realm of fraud claims, you have to look beyond the label, which is a teaching of both this court and the Supreme Court. And I think, you know, part of the reason we are where we are is because the first cases the court got were these consumer fraud cases or deceptive practices cases. And I think we all know that you can use a deceptive practices statute to re-regulate an industry. But you can't use a bribery statute or a kickback statute to re-regulate an industry. And I think that all the claims here are focusing on that conduct. And I just don't think that raises the same problems. We're not suggesting, for example, that the rule is criminal is okay, you know, civil is not. It's not as simple as that. But I do think when you have generally applicable criminal laws like the prohibition on bribery and kickbacks, you don't have preemption. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. The court will take the case under advisement.